Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them. And our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the 4th Estate Bunker on West Jones Street in downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Today, we'll remember a prominent judge, turn our attention to the latest round of redistricting, and revisit the debate about college athletes and the latest twist, public policy, in fact, that would treat the so-called amateurs as potential earners. Your guest on the pod today is a former justice on the North Carolina Supreme Court, a longtime advocate for independent redistricting, and also somebody who supports college athletes being able to sell his or her likeness, their likeness, as part of a true free market. Justice Bob Orr, welcome back to the podcast.
I'm delighted to be here, Jeff.
Want to begin on more of a somber note. Former colleague of yours, I. Beverly Lake, died last week. The son of a segregationist, Lake was a member of the state legislature more than 40 years ago, made an unsuccessful bid for governor as a Republican in 1980. Later, he served on the state's high court for more than a decade. Judge Lake was long considered a law and order conservative, though he broke away from that traditional narrative later in life when he became the leading advocate for, from my perspective, I think most people would say the leading advocate for the innocent. For the Innocence Project and dealing with wrongful convictions. When you heard about his passing last week, I'm wondering what was the first moment, personal moment, from your time with him that came to mind?
Well, I think even though I had known Bev for a good long time, we were both candidates for the Supreme Court in 1994, and he had lost two previous races for the Supreme Court. And I can remember calling him on election night and saying, congratulations, I look forward to serving with you. And he was so cautious. He said, no, Bob, don't get ahead of things. You know, there's still votes out there. And I said, Bev, it's 11:30 and we're 170,000 votes ahead. Nobody's going to catch us. But he was so cautious. But he was just a wonderful, wonderful person and did so many different good things for the state.
Why did he have this transformation later in life, from your perspective, as somebody who knew him and knew the seriousness with which he approached his job and the bench?
Yeah, well, I think Bev was always committed to fairness. And Chris Muma, who had been a law clerk of his and had been actively involved in an Innocence Project during her law school times and then after she left the clerkship, you know, came to Chief Justice Lake and said, we really need, the state really needs to study this issue and look at the kind of reforms that would make a difference, and we need your leadership. And I think it is a credit to Chris's persuasiveness and how much Chief Justice Lake respected her opinion that he said, okay, if you think we need to do it, then I'll get behind it. And so he appointed, I would say, a blue ribbon commission of people from a broad range of perspectives on the criminal justice issue, on the innocence issue, and it was at times contentious, but he was willing to listen to all sides, and I think that was typical of his philosophy of being a judge and his philosophy of life.
You spent years together on the state Supreme Court bench. Is there a particular case that rings in your memory, whether you were in agreement on it or you were in disagreement, or if it percolates for some other reason?
Well, I think the Stevenson case, if for no other reason than it's sort of topical with the redistricting.
Kind of timely, it is, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And Bev was Chief Justice at the time, and there were five elected Republicans on the Supreme Court, two elected Democrats. And the challenge was brought by prominent Republicans challenging the maps that the Democratic-controlled legislature had drawn. And it was a fascinating case, both in the context of the politics and the constitutional issues. And there's a practice sometimes where you get in conference and you say, well, you know, this is the Chief Justice's opinion to write. Mm. And that sort of means this is really important. Mm-hmm. And so the chief needs to be the person that takes the lead responsibility in authoring the opinion. And Bev did, and you know, it was a terribly contentious.
And remind the listeners, yeah, racial gerrymandering or partisan gerrymandering?
Well, Stevenson 1 was the whole county provision. Right. The state constitution required that in drawing districts, you had to honor
the counties. Whenever possible. Yeah.
And the legislature at that time had said, well, because of one person, one vote, because of the Voting Rights Act, it's impossible, so we're going to just ignore it. And so the narrow question in Stevenson was, does the whole county provision have to apply? And of course, the Democrat-controlled legislature wanted the flexibility to ignore them in drawing the districts. And so when the maps were overturned, I mean, there was talk of impeachment. There was, we were all labeled as these horrendous partisan hacks.
Judicial tyrants.
Yeah, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. You know, judicial activism. And the irony is now, 17 years down the road, roughly, the Stevenson case was at the core of the Democrat challenge to the maps that the Republicans drew. And I said back when Stevenson was decided, it was really a good government decision for which Chief Justice Lake and the majority never really got any credit for it being viewed as a good government decision as opposed to a partisan decision.
Let's segue smoothly here into redistricting. Of course, the major ruling from the 3-judge panel came down earlier this month, and legislators have been under this relatively tight timeline to redraw maps. You and I are chatting here on a Tuesday. The court expects these maps, the maps are going to be done maybe late Tuesday, certainly by tomorrow. Then the judges will begin reviewing them with a special master, a map referee, Nathaniel Persily, the Stanford University professor, beginning later in the week. I want to follow up on something that was said and I guess build from there. So last night, Monday night, the North Carolina Senate voted on its iteration of maps. They voted 38-9. So the 9 voting against, there were 8 Democrats and 1 Republican. The 1 Republican was Dan Bishop, Republican from Mecklenburg County, and he said that this was a vote against judicial tyranny, I believe. I mean, he might have worded it some version of that. But he said, you know, this is this major overstep by the judicial branch. And I couldn't help but think of that when you were just talking a moment ago about some of the backlash you all faced 17 years ago. Big picture here, why has it taken until 2019 for partisanship to rise through the courts and be struck down as unconstitutional?
Well,
as opposed to racial gerrymandering, partisan gerrymandering.
Correct.
Sorry to interrupt you. But I'll add one other thing that Bishop made as part of his remarks last night, which I read in news reports. I was not here in the building last night. But just that if what is currently enacted, if the current maps are partisan gerrymanders, then we've had illegal partisan gerrymanders for 200 years in this state. That was part of his position on that. And I just want you to go from there.
We have had partisan gerrymandering for the entire history of the country in one form or another. I read a biography of James Madison, and it came out that in the very first drawing of congressional districts, Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death, didn't want Madison elected to Congress. And so since he controlled the House of Commons in Virginia, he sort of jerry-rigged the map, even though Eldridge Gerry was not a term at that point in time.
Former Massachusetts.
And tried to draw the map so that Madison would lose. And so historically, politics has always been a factor in drawing the map. The majority party in the legislature, has obviously tilted it, no matter who is in charge. And I think an important focus of the 3-judge panel's decision is that they talked about extreme partisan gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's some question still out there as to whether a little bit of partisanship or a little bit of tweaking the districts
political
to favor.
Data.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Maybe that's okay. Yeah. I mean, I read the three-judge panel's decision as saying that that it was the extreme nature of what took place to sort of completely tilt the scales.
Some of the pushback from folks has said, well, if it is extreme, what's the line, right? Well, if that's a bonfire, but what about this smoldering thing of ashes over here? Is that a fire? I mean, how do we establish, if we know this is an extreme partisan gerrymander, what isn't? How close can they get to it? Whether it's and that's not to point a finger at the Republicans, whoever is drawing maps.
Right. Well, that's the great challenge, and I think that was one of the reasons the U.S. Supreme Court, when faced with it, said, we're not getting into it. It's a political question, which leads us into redistricting reform. If you can put in redistricting reforms that get the partisanship out of the process, or as much as practical, and that you have fair and independent maps, then that's the long term solution. I don't think the courts really want to have to start trying to draw a line in every case, because every case is going to be a little different,
and the courts have plenty of other things to do.
I mean, that's a real challenge, and it's obviously a hot button issue. And while courts are, geared to handle hot button issues, they don't want a steady diet of it if they can avoid it. And so that's why, to me, redistricting reform is so important.
So the U.S. Supreme Court passed on partisan gerrymandering earlier this year. They said no justiciability. We've seen some partisan challenges. And I'm sure there are others, but move through state courts with some prominent outcomes over the last year and a half. Pennsylvania, the state Supreme Court there struck down congressional maps. Republican defendants there actually sought relief from the U.S. Supreme Court, but the federal court, and this was before the ruling this year, but they said, no, we're not going to touch this. So Pennsylvania had congressional maps struck down on a partisan basis. It has now since happened here. At the same time, we're also in this moment where everybody's bickering. The fighting is endless. And I'm wondering if you think, are we the collective we, any closer to seeing independent redistricting in North Carolina and in other states? Or do these judicial rulings just further kind of build walls and make it harder to get there?
Well, I think it's important that U.S. Supreme Court noted that state constitutions, which most often have more specific rights and provisions in them, are a vehicle that can put a limit on partisan gerrymandering. I think the public has become far more aware of how easy it is with computer technology and voter data to really stack the deck completely. And I think that was the result of the three-judge panels, or the basis for the three-judge panel, recognizing that it's just gone too far. It's too easy to completely manipulate the system, regardless whether it's, the Democrats in Maryland or the Republicans in North Carolina.
Here in mid-September, what is your – so I guess two-part question. What are you looking – and what are you looking for? What are you following in the next – week to 4 or 5 weeks as it pertains to the court-ordered redistricting here and the next steps? I guess, what are you looking for, and what are your expectations, if you have any, about what's going to happen?
Well, candidly, as you well know, redistricting is not a simple process, no matter what the circumstances. And so I think the bottom line is the legislature will present these maps to the three-judge panel. Unless there's some egregious aspect of it that bumps up against what the court ordered, I think they'll approve them. And so the 2020 election maps will be set. So then the question is, this only applies to the 2020 election, because we'll have a new census, we'll have a new redistricting process. And so will we have reform put in place so that we don't go through this over the course of the next 10 years?
Judge Bob Orr is your guest here on the WNC Politics Podcast, former Associate Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court. He did run unsuccessfully for the Republican gubernatorial nomination back in 2008. You've been on the podcast before. We've talked about amateurism and student athletes. I always use air quotes with that phrase. Some interesting, if not notable, legislation has garnered headlines recently. California and South Carolina, both states. Out west, state senator sponsored a measure that would allow college athletes to sign sponsorship deals. Shockingly, the NCAA is vehemently opposed to this.
Said it was unconstitutional.
They've threatened to ban California teams from participating in any championship events. This legislation is now on the governor's desk, a Democrat, Gavin Newsom. Yesterday, just for a little further context, there was an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal that called this a dream. They said this is really the California dream right here. These kinds of this would not work with union regulations in California. How close do you think we are to this actually happening in California?
Obviously, we're.
I mean, we're one signature away.
We're one signature away. Exactly.
Literally, we're that close.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
How big of a moment is this potentially?
Well, I think it's huge. And I think that the study commission here in North Carolina that Lieutenant Governor Forrest chaired, in which I thought did an exceptionally even-handed job in looking at a range of these kinds of issues, and then legislation was introduced here in North Carolina. I mean, we're really getting close to the tipping point where the general public and elected officials are understanding how fundamentally unfair the system is and how it operates with these 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds who play sports.
And And the advocates like yourself are often quick to note that you have a structure at the moment that has multimillion-dollar coaches and effectively unpaid labor. You have free education for the labor, but this is uncompensated labor in the sense that, I mean, you're retired now, but that you receive compensation for your work or I do for mine.
Well, sure. And, you know, they always say, well, it's the educational benefit. But these young men and women are working 40, 50, 60 hours a week on their sports. And while very gifted academic athletes, you know, can juggle that kind of load, too many, particularly of the you know, lower wealth athletes, you know, they're not really getting a particularly good education. They're getting some education, but it's so I think there's so many issues involving college athletics, and the money is so enormous. It's like I'm sure my friends at UNC don't like me pointing this out, but UNC just built a $50 million indoor practice facility.
Mm-hmm. Football,
which is which is right next to the law school, which looks like a 1960s East Berlin concrete structure. So you have to ask, where are the dollar priorities in higher education when we're pumping that kind of money into athletics and then letting the academic side perhaps slide?
If, big proverbial if, legislation moves in California, becomes law, and then in South Carolina and a couple of other states, do you think it's more likely that we're going to see the NCAA have a tipping point, transformational, reinventive moment? Or is the NCAA going to sue in a number of states? Do you have a thought? It's a totally speculative question.
I have no idea what legal theory they could pursue to challenge the California law. Now, they can, as a members organization, kick Southern Cal and UCLA and all of the schools in the California system out of the NCAA or prohibit them from participating in certain things. But, I mean, it's too big a system. That was sort of the genius of the proposed legislation here in North Carolina that has not moved forward, but it would apply to the entire UNC system. So you pick App State, Carolina, NC State, East Carolina. See. And so at a certain point, the leadership of the NCAA, which is really the presidents and athletic directors, are going to have to address these issues.
A totally random question. I want to ask you about the guests that you have here today. But before we do that, this is a truly a random question. But as a once a child of Boston, how often, if ever, do you get confused with Bobby Orr?
Well,
I don't know if I've ever asked you that before.
Well, really, because I was thinking on our last podcast, I'd been reelected to the Supreme Court in 2002 and was walking in the court and was introduced to the new security officer. And he said, Judge, I want you to know I voted for you. And I said, well, thank you, Eddie. I appreciate it. He says, but I didn't know anything at all about you. And, well, I'm still glad you voted for me. He says, but I'm from Massachusetts, and Bobby Orr was the greatest hockey player who ever lived. So, you know, I have no doubt that at least in the New England transplant sections of North Carolina, I ran better. And I would have to say, since we're talking about, we started talking about Chief Justice Lake, for whatever reason, you have some Demon Deacon bobblehead.
I do. I have a Wake Forest bobblehead doll
yes.
here.
And I have to say, Chief Justice Lake, of course, grew up in the original Wake Forest.
Right.
Went to Wake Forest undergrad and law school. Loved the Deacons and the famous story of him dribbling a basketball down the halls of the Supreme Court with his Wake Forest paraphernalia on, stopping by all of his Carolina friends' offices to remind them that the Deacons had pounded the Tar Heels the night before in basketball. He loved the Deacons.
Finally, before we let you free here, you've got a couple of guests with you today. Tell me about who's here with us in the studio today.
Well, I have two young men, PTA and his brother Cedric, and they are part of a family that has relocated from refugee camps in Rwanda to America and to Raleigh. They have been brought here, their mother, and they have one other brother who's in daycare, mm-hmm. Frankie. They've been brought here as part of the refugee program of Lutheran Immigration Services, and our church has sponsored the family. And so the boys are on track out right now.
Okay.
And so we're having a morning out that was we hadn't really planned on doing a podcast.
I appreciate your flexibility. I really do.
And so the fellas are with me here.
Something you've learned from this experience. This is not an experience that I've had. It seems like it is a fascinating one.
If you can imagine the challenges of relocating, you know, and their mom spent literally over half her life in a refugee camp in Rwanda. No real educational efforts there. Mm-hmm. They got here with virtually no English. The boys speak, you know, they've really done a remarkable job in learning English and learning about American culture. And, you know, the thing that's amazing to me is how enthusiastic and joyful they are in all of the various experiences that, you know, they're being exposed to for the first time. And you know, we all learn from them. We've eaten at McDonald's and had chicken nuggets, and they always save one of the boxes to take home to their mother. You know, so they're very conscious of you know, looking out for each other.
I like it. I'll leave it there.
Yeah.
Former Associate Justice of the State Supreme Court, Bob Orr. You can follow him on Twitter at, simply enough, Judge Bob Orr. Thank you again for being flexible with a busy schedule.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks, as always, for listening. Remember that you can subscribe to the podcast, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And as a reminder, we're having these longer-form conversations earlier in the week now. And at the end of the week, you will hear a review of North Carolina politics with Becky Gray of the Conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield from the Progressive NC Policy Watch. So subscribe to the WUNC Politics podcast feed if you don't already. Feel free to leave us a review or a rating there. And we'll talk to you again soon. For Bob Orr, I'm Jeff Tavere. But you love-